Good afternoon, everyone. We'll go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our colloquium today. It's an absolute honor to welcome Dr. James Shanahan as our speaker today. This talk is part of the Communication Research Colloquium series sponsored by the Communication Research Center. Dr. Shanahan is the Dean of the Media School at Indiana University, and Dr. Shanahan's research interests focus on cultural indicators, cultivation theory, media effects, and public opinion. Special areas of focus are on communication in relation to science and the environment. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. James Shanahan.
Well, it sounds like she actually memorized the word for word the thing that's on my website. Just impressive. Is this like an hour? Is that what we have? Okay. So thank you, Mina, for that very nice introduction. And it is an honor for me to be here presenting to this colloquium and its association with the Comm Research Center, of which I was a member for quite some time, and happy and honored to be such a member. And I remember early days in the Comm Research Center back when Michael was rebooting it, and it went back to, the 60s or the 50s even, right? So this is, in a way, continuing that excellent tradition. Very happy to see it continuing and growing, and honored to be here to give a little talk. So thanks very much. So for those of you who may not know, I had worked here for quite a while, and in fact left here 2 years ago to go to the media school at Indiana University. Happy to see that some things have not changed, like those damn posters that have been here for about maybe a decade or more. But other things that it's nice that they have not changed are the folks in the audience whose faces I know. So thank you for having me back, and very looking forward to talking to all of you after this talk. So this talk is about topic of television and authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is a topic that has become more and more discussed recently for obvious reasons. I was just actually talking to Carol Rivers earlier down in her office, and she said to me, oh yeah, it's authoritarian chic now, like it's a new fashion or something that was coming around. It's interesting to me because authoritarianism is actually a topic that I had studied a lot earlier in my career. In fact, earlier in my career when I was first here at BU, because I had worked here twice, this was in the early 90s, I was very interested in authoritarianism as a political attitude and ideology and so forth, and its relationship to television viewing and media use, which is my area of research interest. So I had been involved with two or three different studies up into the mid-90s that involved authoritarianism. And then I kind of put that aside for other things, and as Mina said, I did a lot more work on environmental and science communication. And anyway, earlier, not this year, later last year, i.e. before the election, things were starting to bubble in terms of Trump and his candidacy. And a few folks were starting to come out in the political science literature, not even really in the official literature, but in blogs and so forth, saying, the thing that really explains whether people will support Donald Trump or not is not their Democrat or Republican or high or low socioeconomic status or whatever. Although I think those things are related, but this argument was being made that it's really about people's authoritarian values, whether they harbor them or not. To many of us, authoritarian sounds like a bad thing, you know, it's overuse of power and too restrictive and so forth. But the idea in the literature is that there are plenty of people who see authority and its use as a good thing. So there are differing views on that. So we'll get into kind of really what authoritarianism is and its relation to media use. And it should be becoming obvious that when these things started popping up in the election, it, you know, my antenna went off because I had been studying authoritarianism, 20 years earlier. And I said, gee, I wonder if this is ripe for an opportunity for us to look at the question of television viewing, authoritarianism in relationship to our now President Donald Trump. And so that's really what this talk is about. So what I'm going to do is just talk briefly about some of the early research that I was involved with. We'll set that up, and then I'll bring this up to a new study that we conducted actually during the election in about October. We conducted the study that I'm going to talk about today, which was, again, before we knew that Trump would be president. In fact, most of us were convinced he wouldn't do that, that he wouldn't be. So how's that sound? Is that okay idea? Okay? Okay, thank you. So let's see. Authoritarianism, it's a commonplace term, so I don't know that it really needs to be defined, although it turns out there are many different ways to define it theoretically and then technically in the literature. And this concept, here's a common definition of it for you. The interest and concern about authoritarianism really goes back quite a way in the social science literature. So if we go back to the 40s and the 50s, 1940s and 50s, social scientists who were looking at obvious things like what had happened with fascism and communism and so forth, there was a lot of concern with authoritarianism, especially the apparent support for it that could be generated amongst populations. And the panic and the fear, like, why would people support this? What is it that they see there? And so the word authoritarian or authoritarianism became very well associated with a work that was called The Authoritarian Personality. This was a work, one of the really milestone social science pieces of American social science, from, I think, published in 1950 maybe or thereabouts, where Theodore Adorno and others had looked at what was happening again with fascism, and were interested in explaining that from a psychological perspective. So their work led to attempts to create measures, psychometric measures that would kind of measure authoritarianism at the individual level, and became very well known for that. They had a scale called the F scale. F stood for fascism, and it was, like many survey measures, a series of questions that could be asked to determine just how authoritarian are you or not. The term personality indicates that in their approach, and theirs was really probably the first major approach, in their approach, the idea was kind of a psychoanalytic one, that there's something in people's personality that comes from, you know, how mommy raised them or what have you. That would be then this enduring personality trait that would bleed over into all parts of life. And the general outlines of it would be that the authoritarian would be subservient to power to persons above him or her in terms of power relationships, and more abusive or wielding power over persons below him or her. Compared to what they kind of implicitly portrayed as a more well-adjusted, non-authoritarian personality, which would favor things more like discussion and deliberation to reach solutions, rather than powerful or authoritative means to just solve problems in that way. So this was a very seminal piece of work that really brought authoritarianism to the fore, and was in and of itself a major focus for social science of this kind. It was also very controversial, and so their work attracted a lot of criticism in terms of how they measured authoritarianism. If you can go into the literature and see probably dozens of different ways that folks have argued that this should be measured, like any social science construct, I suppose. later in the 80s, and this was more when I was starting to get interested in it myself, Robert Altmaier focused on something that he called right-wing authoritarianism. He thought that's really what Adorno et al. Were talking about. And you know, you can distinguish between different kinds of authoritarianism that you can be left-wing and authoritarian as well. But he was really focusing on that. And he also did not see it so much as the kind of psychoanalytic personality trait that that Adorno began with. He focused more on what we would call a social learning or maybe a social cognitive perspective, which says that it's just something we learn from our environment, whether that's from our parents or from our coworkers or our friends, or what was interesting to me at the time, vicarious learning that could occur through media models that we might get. So I was very interested in Altmaier's work as a possible explanation of do the media messages that we consume play any role whatsoever in the development of this attitude. After Altmaier, there are other perspectives that have said that authoritarianism really is maybe more of a predisposition, and it comes out in response to certain things. Probably the most common thing that it would come out in response to would be an external threat of some kind. So, you know, if your country's invaded or something like that, and you say, oh, we gotta really crack down on everything and, you know, get our ship in order here so we can fight this external threat. That would be an idea of an external threat motivating more authoritarian attitudes for the moment, after which people then might dial back to something a little less authoritarian. So these are three different kinds of, just three examples of perspectives that that we can take on authoritarianism. There are actually others, and of course, the other idea of authoritarianism is just that some governments are more authoritarian than others. As examples, I used, this is just a graph to show you kind of a range of countries that are considered to be more or less authoritarian with data from Freedom House, which measures purportedly, objectively, the freedom level of a country. So I picked out some ones. Canada would score, this is a score that can range from 0 to 100, and it's based on all different kinds of political and civil freedoms that countries can have or not have, different kinds of laws and so forth. They came in just under 100. I don't know what they did to, like, didn't get that last point. They're so close. Anybody know, like, is there some freedom they don't have in Canada? Anyway. This is to give you a sense of just the range. Freedom House would consider for us, US, to be slightly less free, but these are on the left side of my diagram, countries that are considered to be free democracies. What's next? Italy. And then we go into countries that, Romania, Mexico, Ukraine, that may or may not have had at one time or do have kind of one-party systems or systems where one party is very dominant, with kind of apparent oppositions that aren't really effective. And then we get more and more into countries that really are just one-party states or their theocracies, or in the case of North Korea, you know, a complete totalitarian system. In their case, I don't know what they did to get 5 points, you know, instead of zero. So that's just a sense of the range of authoritarianism, authoritarian political structures that we have currently in the world today. And of course, we have within countries constant fluctuations up or down, with the obvious implication of my comment here being that currently in the US, we're all wondering where we are going in relationship to our own position on authoritarian solutions in the United States. Now, as Mina mentioned, my work has focused a lot on something called cultural indicators, or also cultivation theory. And so cultivation theory, for those who, many of you do know, but very quickly for those of you who don't know, the idea here is a pretty simple one. This is an idea that was developed by George Gerbner, who was the dean of Communication at Annenberg in Pennsylvania. The idea was pretty simple that in his time, most of the, or a lot, I would say, of the media effects research was focused on kind of direct imitation of things that we would see in violence studies, or studies on the impact of news, maybe on beliefs and agendas and so forth. And Gerbner was more interested really in two things. One was that he kind of cared more about the fictional world of television, because especially at his time, that's what people were watching the most of. And he thought, rather than be concerned about, will I imitate the murder that I saw on Hawaii Five-O, let's say, because we were talking about that show earlier, the old one, not the new one. Gerbner was interested more in the question of, over time, if I'm watching these shows over and over again, what lessons will I learn? And will I internalize lessons that come from that world, the TV world, as it is so often called? And so this became a very well-known, I guess I would say, idea in the communication literature. It's been around since then, so since 1967 or so, we're now 50 years later. There are occasional calls in the literature to somehow get rid of this concept. It's too old and tired. There was, in fact, one just last week, but it keeps coming back, probably because of people like me. Because, in fact, it is, a fairly simple, if not simplistic, idea that can be explanatory in certain kinds of situations. Gerbner's, one of his most well-known constructs was this idea of the mean world syndrome, which would argue that if we look at our mediated experience, again, mainly, let's say, fictional television was what he was interested in, how will that influence what we perceive in the world around us, where his simple idea was, you know, if you watch television in a year and you see 1,000 murders, let's say, and in your real life you see zero, hopefully, how will that experience influence your fear in the real world? So there's a pretty good body of research that shows that if you are a heavy viewer of that kind of stuff, you will be more fearful. It was interesting to me when Trump was saying that the murder rates were unprecedentedly high in the United States. You remember this from maybe a month or so ago? He was saying murder rates are through the roof. They're at an unprecedented high. If in fact you look at murder rates since the 60s, they've mostly gone way down. There is like a little uptick recently. I don't know if I would call it an uptick, but anyway, his use of that in a way to encourage fear and presumably more support for strong and authoritative solutions to that law and order type stuff would be a very typical argument of Gerbner. That would be the kind of thing that would have concerned him and really why he was interested in studying television at all. Not because he was a big fan of popular television at the time, but more because he thought these are the messages that we're consuming, so let's look at what they might be telling us. There's a picture of George Gerbner on the right. That guy on the left is Michael Morgan, who became my doctoral advisor and who is a co-author on this study I'm going to talk about later. So that is a kind of a view of cultivation theory. So what about cultivation and authoritarianism? Well, Gerbner's ideas were pretty strong, although I don't think he really used the term authoritarianism much, but he was clearly interested in power, messages and lessons about power, and the effectiveness that the media could have in portraying stories that would convey those lessons. Because after all, a story is usually something that ends with a conclusion, maybe a lesson, a moral, some outcome, something that we learn from that story. Gerbner was very interested in this. He had, as a Hungarian, and in his early career in Europe, he was interested in mythologies and folk tales and that kind of thing, and poetry. And he saw, actually, television as sort of a more modern, commercialized variant of that. So, in terms of cultivation and authoritarianism, the idea is fairly straightforward then, that media messages have been documented to, you know, there are pretty high levels of violence there. In fact, Michael and I and another colleague, Nancy Signorelli, are just completing an article that reviews now the entire 50-year data set that Gerbner started on this question and now ends in 2015 of data consistently about what's the level and nature of violence in television. And it has been, just to boil it down to one graph, it's been pretty much a straight line in which between 60 and 70% of programs have had some type of violence. So this is, I've already made this comment, sort of Gerbner's idea about television messages as an expression of power. And he went so far as to say that he would see it as sort of the cultural arm of the existing political order, that one serves, that each serves the other in interesting ways. Let's not forget also then what was occurring to me was that Trump, whatever he is, was mainly a television personality. You know, I know he was a real estate tycoon and whatever else, but his main relationship to those that would eventually be voting for him was as a television personality and an entertainment television personality. So the advent of reality television had some interesting consequences here that we could talk about. So Gerbner was finding this in the U.S. data as early as the early and mid-70s, because he started with his colleagues early on. When I came around and I started doing my graduate work in the later 80s, the first place I had an opportunity to look at this was actually in Argentina, because my advisor, Michael Morgan, had done work there and gathered data there, and I eventually gathered data there as well, and that became the focus of my dissertation. So my dissertation was not only about authoritarianism, but it was a big part of it, political attitudes in general and authoritarianism specifically. And Argentina, at the time we studied it, had been a country that was coming out of a military dictatorship that was very explicitly authoritarian and pretty brutal also. So we were now looking at, and the data that we looked at were in Argentina and later in the US, adolescents. So just to give you a flavor of some of those early studies, kinds of questions we would ask, this is from the late 80s, we had data from high schoolers in Argentina, mostly in Buenos Aires. A lot of different questions were used, some of which were actually taken from the Adorno work, or that questions that were typically used in like the general social survey and so forth. And so an example of a question would be a statement, actually, people are better off if they do as they are told. Sounds like something that, you know, we might all disagree with. But in fact, what we found was these next few charts are really just showing you how light, medium, and heavy viewers break out on some of these kinds of key questions, that heavy viewers amongst Argentine adolescents more likely to agree with that statement. And you can see actually a fair percentage of them are, upwards of 30 and 40% are agreeing with that statement. And this is to show you not only the relationships with viewing, but to give you a sense of some of the kinds of questions that were asked that people thought were important to determine, are you an authoritarian or are you more of a liberal or civil libertarian type of person? So good one for here, the journalism school, newspapers should be allowed to criticize the government. This is the percent, again, in Argentina, same thing, who said either only sometimes or never. And you can see that percentage also increases with viewing. Now, let me just say before I go on, we've never in our work taken the stance that, you know, we think television viewing is really the only cause of any of this thing. There are many variables that impact these beliefs, including basic demographic variables, political and ideological ones. And in the work we do, we try to take as many of those into account as possible. So I'm not going to clutter up these analyses with that kind of thing, but I also don't want you to think that I think that television is sort of a magic propaganda tool that is always effective and injects its message in that way. What we think really is that it plays a role along with a lot of other things. Last one from Argentina. This was a big issue there. because the military dictatorship was responding to what they perceived to be a communist insurgency, basically. So this is whether communists should be allowed to freely express themselves. And you can see a pretty high percentage of people were saying no, or it doesn't matter. So like I said, I did my dissertation on that topic, and I think there was, you know, a lot of things that were interesting and concerning and disturbing and so forth. Argentina eventually moved off on its own course through history in some interesting ways. Didn't necessarily collapse back into authoritarianism necessarily, but had a lot of ups and downs. And I'm flashing forward now to the early 90s when I was actually sitting in the office suite down there on the second floor. Barton, I think your office was down there at that time. And Toby was in there with me, and Chris Cakebread, I don't think, is here, but who else was in there? Well, Alan Holliday was there. Anyway, so this is when my first was a faculty member here at BU, and I decided to collect similar data amongst U.S. high schoolers. So we did a survey, a couple of surveys here, focused on New England high schools, actually. Again, 9th through 12th graders, trying to focus on similar kinds of questions. In that study, we made a composite measure from the kinds of questions that I just showed you to look at, were there similar tendencies in the U.S.? And the answer is that there were. This is a boiled down version of that composite measure. One thing I learned along the way that was interesting is that if you quiz or if you ask high schoolers about these questions, they tend to have more authoritarian answers the younger they are. There's a phenomenon called adolescent authoritarianism, which argues that in our adolescent youth, we tend to have a little bit more, I guess, black and white version of or vision of the way things are, and are more likely to advocate for authoritarian solutions. And as we go up through the years of high school, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, you see these numbers drop. So seniors, all things being equal, are less authoritarian than their freshman colleagues. The argument could be made that they've taken their civics courses, they've matured as individuals. You know, many different explanations could be there, but it's a very consistent finding that you see that evolution towards less authoritarianism as they go through the educational process, and more educated people in general also are less authoritarian. So college degree would predict less authoritarian. Higher socioeconomic status would do the same. All right, so there's an example of from the U.S. And another example from the same data set is to show you this idea called mainstreaming. I don't think I explained it earlier. Probably skipped by it. This is just the idea that if you have groups in society that differ from each other, and this is usually on political or ideological issues, we very often observe that the differences are greater when they are light viewers than when they are heavier viewers. This is pretty common when we look at ideological comparisons. So here's an example from that data set where you have on the bottom here the higher SES students. This is students whose parents had higher incomes or what have you, were lower in authoritarianism. These were your low SES students, higher in authoritarianism. And then we make the comparison across classes of viewing. And you can see now why it's called mainstreaming. So it's this idea of more ideological homogeneity amongst heavy viewers. So that's the background for kind of studies that I had been involved with. And then, like I said, I did a lot of other things. And flash forward into fall of 2016, and these issues are now popping up again with Donald Trump and his success in the electoral process. So this this study is by both Michael Morgan and myself. He just called me up one day, or I called him, I can't remember, and said, remember all those authoritarian studies we did, you know, back in the, 1890s, whenever it was? Do you still have those data? Yeah, I could find them. You know, we started looking at the data, and I said, well, why don't we just see what's going on here? Because we wanted to see what was happening, of course, in relationship to Donald Trump. And we had a chance to do it while the election was going on, so we tried to jump on it in that way. This study, as I've said, I'm going to kind of present the condensed version. If you want to see the full one, it will come out in June in the Journal of Communication with the full complement of data and so forth. So the first question we had was, Donald Trump, is he an authoritarian? Anybody answer that for me?
Using what definition of authoritarian?
Any of the three I just gave you. How about those?
He's a pretend authoritarian.
He's a pretend authoritarian. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to take a rest from talking for a while. And so thank you for saving me. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he is really, and nor do I think very many people know that. And it's been very common now in the circles, in university circles that I move in, to see things generating to explain Donald Trump. I'm not going to explain his personality for you at all, but he was, in many ways, coming across as the guy, the law and order guy, the quote, I am your voice. I did select that picture a little bit for rhetorical purposes. He also said, I go my way with the confidence of a sleepwalker. Actually, he didn't say that. You know who said that? Hitler said that, but it sounds like Trump might have said it. Because Trump seems to me just to like go and, you know, I don't know how much thought he gives to things, but he's been spectacularly successful. And it could be an electoral college accident, it could be a historical accident, I don't know. But it does seem that there's warrant to look at the role of authoritarian values and attitudes in explaining his rise to power. And of course, not just Trump, but there are similar movements going on nationwide, some more successful than others. And actually, in a way, when I go back to the title of this, when we had put authoritarianism aside, or especially when I had put it aside and started focusing on other things, as the years went by, I thought, oh, those were quaint days when I was studying authoritarianism, you know, and maybe we won't have to worry about that anymore. And that was probably a naive view. And so in a way, so Trump is the return of the unexpected friend, meaning of the question of authoritarianism. So this is what he was saying at the time of the Republican National Convention. So we just decided to do basically a cultivation approach to this question. I think we knew that we would see the continued relationships between television viewing and authoritarianism. And I think we also suspected that we would see relationships between authoritarianism and voting for Trump, or preferences to vote for Trump, because these other political science studies had been finding that, at least in the blogs that were circulating around. And the question then is, like, what would the overall relationship be in this situation, in this circumstance? So this is kind of the model we tested, where we're looking for, that would be the cultivation relationship of authoritarianism that we had seen so much. This would be what the political scientists were finding. And this would be the question of, is there a direct relationship, or is it just an indirect? It could also be an indirect relationship, or it could be both, or it could be neither. So that's what we set out to test. We did a survey. This was in October 2016, maybe late September, early October, about 1,000 respondents that we gathered, an adult national sample. Pretty quick survey focused mainly on these issues. So questions about authoritarianism, about political preference, about media use, and demographics. Now, to measure authoritarianism, like I said earlier, this has been a controversial issue over the years. How do you measure it? I showed you some of the questions that have been used earlier. Newspapers should be allowed to criticize the government. People are better off if they do as told. There's also versions that go into more personality and family. In my Argentina study, I had versions focused on school and authority, because I thought that was an interesting topic. How do we respond to teachers? Should we just do what they say? Should we question them? Those kinds of things. But in the intervening period, there was a lot of research on authoritarianism and best ways to measure it. And one that came out that's been used most commonly, and so we decided to rely on this, was this measure, which starts with a statement about how people think children should be raised, okay? So the idea here is to get at authoritarianism, not through direct statements like, are you authoritarian or not, but more sort of like values about how children should be raised. And it's been found that this is a pretty reliable measure, and it does correlate with a lot of the more explicitly political things that I talked about earlier. So these are the qualities, with the authoritarian ones underlined. So I'd like to think that I raised my daughter with all the nice liberal things on the left, but realize that as a parent, you also have to focus on things on the right as well. And there's probably a balance there. And then this balance of, weighing towards one side or another has been found to correlate pretty interestingly with the political measures that come later, but it has the virtue of not being explicit about the politics and sensitizing the respondents to it. So that becomes just basically like a 4-point scale that we can use and has been used pretty consistently in the literature. So just some basic findings. Would we see greater authoritarianism by television viewing? Well, I'm not going to put up the chart unless that would be stupid. I mean, it would be more honest, but by the way, there are a lot of interesting things in the data that are confirming of our hypotheses. There's other things that are also confusing and interesting too. So I don't want you to get the sense that I think the whole thing is just a magical confirmation of what we're doing. So that's you might be interested, which candidates would have more authoritarian values associated with their voters? By the time we were involved in the election, we had only three left. So Cruz, what's his first name? Ted Cruz had dropped out, leaving only Sanders, Clinton, and Trump. So the most authoritarian voters would be what? It's not a trick question. And the least would be? And then Clinton should be in the middle? Yeah, so that does happen. And, so there's a little bit of validity there, I think, for the idea that's what we would have expected. Oh, this was not really what we were testing. We were not trying to predict who would win the election. By the way, if we had used our survey to predict who would win the election, we would have also been wrong with a lot of other polls and surveys that were done at the same time. We're kind of pollsters in the same way, but we're looking more at theoretical relationships. Our call of the election would have been off by a few points, just like the other ones were. So in the end, the model that we really saw supported was this one. So we do have that relationship between television viewing and authoritarianism that I've seen in so many other studies. That was not surprising. And we do have this relationship between authoritarianism and support for Trump, which is confirming what these other studies were finding. What we do not have is a direct relationship. So if you just look at television viewing and Trump, you won't see that direct relationship there. This number refers to the significance of that indirect relationship. Okay? So we're seeing, and we kind of thought that we would see this, an indirect relationship on support for Trump through authoritarianism. There are some direct relationships in the data set that wouldn't be very surprising to you. If you think about Fox News, for instance, viewership, which we measured, and Trump voting, that's a pretty strong correlation. No surprise to anyone that Fox viewers would be more likely to support Trump, even though Fox wasn't very supportive of Trump, especially early on. That's wouldn't surprise anyone. Nor, I think, would it be surprising that if we just looked at viewing any other channel besides Fox, that would in fact be a negative relationship. I don't think it's controversial to assert that we know that viewership of these cable channels is strongly correlated to political preferences. So that's just kind of giving you a sense of what direct relationships can often look like. The relationship for overall viewing and authoritarianism and Trump support is more, is a subtler one and perhaps more of a residual one. At the time we were writing, we wondered if it mattered, because we were probably presenting these data originally before the election. And so this was from 538.com showing the tracking of Clinton and Trump at that time. You can see that they had Clinton well ahead at this point. And even when we were writing early drafts of the paper, we were saying, well, we'll see if this matters for the election or not, maybe not. And of course, it turned out that it did in a way that surprised a lot of people. A final footnote is that we were able to insert a lot of these questions in another study called the Cooperative Congressional Election Study. This was through our connection with Nancy Signorelli at Delaware, and she was able to insert questions in their much bigger and more comprehensive survey about the election than our smaller study. And so I was able to just kind of confirm or disconfirm a few things. Even with their measure of television viewing, which is a little different than ours, you do see higher authoritarianism amongst the heavy TV viewers, and the same relationship for the Trump voters and the non-Trump voters. And finally, we did test that same model that I just showed you in these data as well. So with slightly different measurement and so forth, it actually has a very similar model coming out. So I think that was interesting confirmation, I think, of what we were doing in our own study. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us with some questions. One thing I'd like to point out is we've had the same or similar television system for a pretty long time, and during most of those years, we didn't have what we would call classically authoritarian presidents. So if you took a very like mechanistic linear view that television viewing causes authoritarianism, clearly that can't work because, you know, other forces have overwhelmed television in those years. What seems to be, I think, a better or more likely explanation is that is kind of the idea of authoritarianism as sort of a latent thing that can be called out or that can be brought out, oftentimes in response to even just the random historical course of events, to external threats, as I mentioned earlier, to things like that. And so we see that happening now to some extent. And as scholars or just as citizens, we become interested in what explains that. So I'm kind of making an argument that television is a piece of that explanation. I'm talking mainly about entertainment fictional television, which we must also recognize has itself greatly changed since the early years when Gerbner studied it, where you had three networks and, you know, very homogenous. Although in many ways, the different options that we have now can lead to more viewing and sometimes more exposure to the same kinds of content. But I don't want to say, you know, the presentation is kind of about television, not so much about news, and those are other questions that would be interesting to talk about. So that's one piece of it, that television is kind of a part of a suite of explanations that we're still struggling to put together. The other thing to keep in mind is that we've never really thought that the relationship is unidirectional or from one thing to another. With something like television viewing, where we grow up with it, we're enculturated with it, that's the reason for the word cultivation. It's part of our enculturation into being a social being, a political being as well. If you wanted to make the argument that it's really authoritarians who, you know, people who are already authoritarian who will watch more television, well, that's a reasonable argument to make. I think it actually probably tends to go both ways, and that can be a little more difficult to test in the kinds of models that we use. We did actually test the various different models that are possible with those three main variables that we had, and most of the other models are not successful in capturing what the data are saying. So I should probably leave time for questions preceded by vigorous applause and cheering. Cheer. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. In the old days, we would simply ask you, how many hours do you watch television a day? Or we might get sophisticated and say, how many do you watch in the afternoon and night? And so you didn't have to worry about anything else because that just meant three networks. And it was always that broad, homogeneous kind of viewing that we wanted to capture. What we do now is, it is a more complex question that says, and I'm paraphrasing the wording, it would say like, considering all the ways and devices on which you might watch television, including but not limited to your cell phone, your watch, your Google glasses, your barn window, I don't know, you know, whatever. And don't forget regular old television. So we ask them to think about all of those things. What it actually gives us is now higher estimates of the amount that people watch. And I don't think it, you know, our question is not to be accurate about how much you watch in an absolute sense. It's more of a relative kind of thing. So if we were comparing my viewing measures from this study back to the early 90s, like I was talking about, there would be differences, you know. But your question is an interesting one because it's a more common criticism of cultivation to say, in this new era of viewing diversity, let's say, does it even make sense to think about people being exposed to this common set of messages? And so we argue that it still does, and there's a long argument for that, and others don't buy it, and you know, you could come down where you want. But in terms of actually asking the question, and you know, I'm sensitive to reports that come out, it seems like every month, about estimates of just screen time, you know, which is not always, you know, you're not always watching television, obviously, but sometimes you are watching television on your phone. And I think there is still reasonable to talk about an awful lot of viewing going on, even if it's not just on your television anymore. I asked my daughter, like 10 years ago, what TV shows do you like? She goes, I don't watch television, Dad. I'm like, but you were just telling me about this show you like. She goes, well, that was on Hulu. I mean, she didn't consider it television, you know? Television is something old people watch, like me. So it is something that you have to consider when you're measuring it. I'm not saying we have the best or the only way, but it's definitely an issue for us. And of course, by the way, the other thing I wanted to say is really, one big thing that changed in television over the years, when I was originally doing my studies, there was not really a lot of reality television. Reality television came more in the 90s, and of course, Donald Trump became himself an icon for one mode of reality television, which I consider to be kind of another form of scripted television, just without the script, if you know what I mean. And his persona as, you know, you're fired and this kind of thing, you know, when people hear that I'm going to give a talk about television and Trump, they think it's going to be about that, you know. And it's not about that, but it is in a way about that. And I'd be interested to figure that out. So, who else? Yes, sir.
A question. So when you discuss President Trump saying things like, oh, like the murder rates are up, to reinforce some sort of like, fear to the public, I feel like other media platforms are kind of responsible as well. I mean, like I've been checking Facebook today and all I see is like the terrorist attack in like London. I guess my question is like, being an average media consumer, do you have any suggestions on like how we can like stay objective, or how do we avoid?
Who's the average consumer, you or me?
Like, yeah, students.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I am too, probably.
Oh, really? So, like, how do we avoid the meme wars?
How do you avoid it?
Yeah.
Well, it's like anything else. Education is the best tool. We were often asked, you know, as if you were a parent, let's say, how would you raise your child with respect to these kind of media? Would you just prevent them from seeing it, you know, that sort of thing? And I never argued for that. Or would you make rules that would outlaw it? And I never argued for that. There's good reasons for not doing any of those things. I think the best argument is, I guess the way I would explain it is, in our new media environment where we have, and you're talking about Facebook and a terrorist attack in
London.
In London? Okay, I haven't heard about it actually because I've been, so I'll go look at that. I'm afraid. But that kind of thing, you know, we've had social media really since when? 10 years now, that'd be right to say, you know? And any new media evolution, I think, when it comes along, there's going to be tendencies at first to say, oh, this is great, we can do this and that and everything with it. And Facebook could mean a new democracy, a new way of everybody having a publishing platform and all that. And you can find your old girlfriend from high school too, you know? And then things happen that show you, oh, is there a dark side to it too, you know? Like, oh, did somehow Twitter lead to an authoritarian president? I'm not saying that's true necessarily, but you know, we can think about it. And so society has to like work through these kinds of things. You can see previous media revolutions where, you know, you have the good side and the bad side and you gotta figure it out and move on towards something new. So I think the only solution for your dilemma is not to turn off Facebook, although some people will argue it might be good to do that every once in a while. They call it a Sabbath, I think. Take a Sabbath from your Facebook. How long could you put off your Facebook, do you think?
I don't know.
Could you give me your phone right now and I could hold it for 10 minutes?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, I mean, we have 5 minutes. Could you do it for 5 minutes? I would give you my phone. You don't want to. Like, your phone is very personal, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to check it right now. It's from you. No. I had once, I think it was a class I was teaching here, I said, like, can you, maybe it was even before Facebook, like, can you not have media for a week? And of course, there was the famous TV turnoff week, which was like an experiment to say, are you going to feel happier or sad at the end of it? I experienced that as a kid because my father was anti-television, and our TV broke once, and this is when they had tubes and you had to go replace the tubes, and he said, I'm not going to replace the damn TV. You can all read books and play games. And we, of course, were very mad because we wanted to watch television. But after about a week or so, we actually did that for a good year. And then I think the Super Bowl came around. We got television again. So meme world syndrome, it's an educational aspect, you know. And it's even a question of to what degree are we really governed by the meme world syndrome. I give the example all the time of when I raised my daughter in the 90s again as a young girl. As parents, we kept our kids close. You didn't let them go run around the city. You know, if you did, you might have been pulled in for being a bad parent. And there was just fear of, you know, too much ungoverned free time for those kids. Although when I was a kid, my mom let us run all over the city on our bicycles and just come home by dinner. Well, at the time I was running around the city, the crime rates were actually higher than when I was keeping my daughter at home. So, kind of a good, you know, meme world example. Because when I said that to students, what explains that, they start to think, oh yeah, it must be that show, you know, Walsh, what was that show? A guy trying to find people who abduct children, basically, because his son had been abducted. So it's not a fancy explanation, but I think education and sensitivity to it. Yes?
Thank you for your presentation, Dr. Shannon. I have a general question about the idea of authoritarian, because I think the first time I heard of the concept is from the book Four Theories of the Press.
Four Theories of the Press, yes.
And I think actually it's interesting that, because I think that book is actually based on the Cold War situations, and I think one critique is that they have like too many labels and to the press system, because, you know, due to globalization, actually now every country has like different practices. Even in my country, China, we have libertarian practices as well. So I think not only in academia, but in real world, what do you think of the idea, like how can we perceive our political or press resistance? Because I think your focus is like one aspect, but maybe we also have the libertarian aspect, and we also have the social responsibility aspect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, in that book, authoritarian press system meant simply that the press was controlled by a king or a government, something like that. They also had a separate one, I think, for the Soviet idea, which to me would just be another authoritarian system, but they differentiated them a little bit. And the libertarian idea would be a free, basically ungoverned press, you know. So that idea of authoritarianism is linked to, but not the same as what I'm talking about. But your point is that there should be more labels now, or too many labels? I didn't quite follow it.
I think my point is that the critique is about not attaching too many labels to things, because, you know, like
the critique of the book, you mean?
Yes.
Oh.
But I think labels themselves do cultivate beliefs and attitudes.
Yeah.
And I think it's like schemas or something like that. So I think another thing that's important is that we actually need to realize the real meanings of labels, you know, not just say that we don't use them at all.
I see. Well, that's an interesting comment. I agree that it's important not to attach too many labels to things, although, of course, the entire process of social science research is attaching labels to things and then measuring them, you know. And you know, the word authoritarian, is it a good word or not? You know, that's an interesting point to consider. Because I think most people put a pretty negative connotation on it. But when we want to talk about people who use power effectively or in ways that we agree with, we call it leadership, maybe, or, you know, effective political governance, you know. And there's plenty of times when we're in situations, it could be a small student group or a faculty meeting or a college or whatever, and if we think we're not getting good, strong leadership, we'll complain about that too, right? So, you know, I agree with you. Authoritarianism is most offensive the more extreme it becomes. The less extreme it becomes, we tend to call it something else, you know? And so the labeling probably needs to evolve, as always. Yes?
Jim, I know that you'd mentioned that you're showing us just a subset of the data that you guys have collected. Did you ever look at how television maybe, or viewing in terms of the amount, interacts with maybe culture, or whether or not they have authoritarian values, or where they're coming from? I'm just kind of curious.
You mean culture, like their...
Perhaps,
like,
you know, where, like, I know earlier on you showed us the countries, right?
Oh, right.
In terms of, you know, how authoritarian those countries are, because I'm kind of wondering if there could be potentially the resonance effect of where, if you are experiencing those on an everyday basis, or, you know, you're socialized for...
Not in this data, and the only time I had done that was when we did the data in Argentina, because that was a country that had come out of a very authoritarian structure. So if you know, if you think we have it bad now, it was brutal military dictatorship, people disappearing and stuff like that. But with plenty of people supporting that, saying yes, authoritarianism is what we need. And of course, Argentina had the legacy of Juan Perón, you know, who is a sort of classic authoritarian. But in our data set here, no, we didn't really have a lot of questions that would say, like, if we knew your national origin, or, you know, we have race measures. We didn't plunge into those too much. It'd be interesting to do that, though. What do you think would happen?
I'm just curious if there would be potential, like, a resonance effect where, depending on, of course, if you are practicing those types of values, or that you are from those countries that, you know, or at least would be ranked higher in authoritarian.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a third-person effect, like, if you do this, you say, I'm not authoritarian. I'm a patriot, you know, or I'm just a good American or whatever, you know, and so it'd be another study, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Dennis?
I may ask the last question, but basically I'm curious about authoritarian content. You know, why do media want to relay authoritarian content, and why do people consumers attracted to authoritarian content, and how does this kind of sentiment gets relayed to the audience itself? Yeah. I mean, authoritarian ideas are at odds with media operation. Why do media want to broadcast that like they did with violence? Violence attracted people, but does authoritarian content attract people as well?
Well, it depends on how conspiratorial your mindset is, you know. I think that Gerbner thought he had a pretty conspiratorial view of it, which is that these are media systems that are corporate. They really operate in tandem with the government.
Right.
They're licensed by the government in return for benefits that they provide to the government in terms of publicity and so forth. He had a very, you know, that kind of critical view out there. I don't think he ever really proved that particular case, you know. In terms of then why violence and or authoritarian values would be attractive, the easiest explanation is, Gerbner's explanation is that violence is a very formulaic and easy way to, you know, what people want is compelling stories and narratives. And of course, there's compelling narratives that go back to the Bible and beyond before that have violence in them. And many would make an argument that every drama must have some compelling conflict, at least of some kind, or nobody's going to watch it. So there's this sort of naturalistic argument that you can make that this is what those are attractive narratives for that reason. And so that if violence is attractive for that reason, the compelling hero who solves problems, not usually by saying, let's sit down and talk about it, but more by saying, you know, I will fix this, whether it's the cop, whether it's the superhero, whether it's, you know, whatever kind of hero, that those are compelling narratives. So psychologically, why is that? That's an interesting question. I think television likes them, if I could make a generalization about television, because it's effective, it can be less expensive to produce that. And then actually when they went into the reality show era, they found an even more effective way of doing it, which is saying, let's just put people in conflict situations. We don't even have to pay actors or writers anymore, you know? So you were asking me about watching The Real Housewives earlier, which of course I never would do, except every Wednesday. But there's a show that's a very interesting example of that, where, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see how the producers kind of put people in positions so that you get that conflict. It doesn't always create violence in their setting, although sometimes it does. It's like watching a stock car race, that's why you go to see it. So I think that's why, you know, I don't sort of buy into the television as the cultural arm of the existing political order. That was Gerbner's take on it. I think it's more a characteristic of our system, and that this is how it works out for television messages in general. Some people made interesting criticism. They would say, like in response to Cultivation, they would say, you know, television shows a lot of kissing and hugging, so why shouldn't that cultivate more love, you know? Which is a good question, right? Not something we ever investigated, maybe we should, you know. So I think it's, you know, narratives, we understand pretty well the classical ones that seem to work. Doing ones that are compelling without resort to formulaic devices is harder and more expensive, and fewer people might watch them anyway. So that's kind of the best explanation I could give of that.
Thank you so much, Jim. Okay. Thank you.